Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. I'm joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. And this is episode number 5 of Great Debates in Fitness and in Health. We're just going to debate topics that you guys asked of us. And this will force us to take some really interesting stances at times, which we do. But I don't know. I think it's fun. What do you like this format?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it makes us contort ourselves in ways that we objectively disagree with, but it can be entertaining to work through different nuances of these questions. So I'm good with it.
And various, like, quote, rebuttals that people would make to, you know, these things. So we have a good sense on most of these topics, what the counter arguments are, and then the holes in those arguments, which we try to explain in this format. Now, it is a loose program. This is not a, you know, formal debate. We don't have a moderator. We don't have a timer. We don't have, you know, we didn't prepare a lot for this, you know, trying to really convince the audience that one of us is right. But I do think that these are areas we have good expertise in. So the format is as follows: 5 minutes per question. There's 10 questions. So you guys get a sense of what the time commitment you're getting into here. So, you know, plan accordingly. The person who starts is going to be able to pick affirmative or negative. So arguing for or against the proposition. They get 2 minutes. Then there's a 2-minute rebuttal by the other individual, and then a 1-minute rebuttal from the person who led. And we'll alternate who goes for first. But again, don't hold us to these time caps. If you're like, oh, that was 6 minutes, it doesn't necessarily mean that the information was bad. So, you know, sit back, enjoy the ride. Austin, anything you want to get off your chest before we pop into this?
No, nothing has been weighing on me too bad, and I do not have any active chest pain. So let's do it.
No dolor de pecho. Got it. All right. Question number one, proposition number one. Many foods contain carbohydrates, which ultimately supply energy to the cells in our body. Now, once ingested, carbohydrates are broken down in the gastrointestinal tract into simple sugars like glucose. In the small intestine, glucose molecules are absorbed into the bloodstream and transported to the liver and around the body. As blood glucose levels rise, insulin is produced by the beta cells of the pancreas in response. Now, after eating, insulin facilitates the transportation of glucose and other nutrients from the bloodstream into cells like muscles, organs, and fat. Normal blood sugar ranges vary by the type of test and timing in relation to the previous meal. In general, a normal fasting blood sugar level is between 65 to 99 milligrams per deciliter. And after a meal, blood sugar typically runs between 100 to 140 milligrams per deciliter. Now, many people claim that blood sugar should be tightly controlled in order to avoid, quote, blood sugar spikes, unquote. Though most do not define what a blood sugar spike is objectively. So with that in mind, the debate proposition is as follows. Blood sugar spikes should be avoided. Austin, I'll let you take the lead and you get to respond in the affirmative or the negative.
Okay. Yeah, you alluded to one of the issues with this question being specifically that blood sugar spikes, quote unquote, is not a really clearly defined entity. I'm going to say that broadly speaking, in terms of the concept, I'll say yes, that they should be avoided. But that hinges, of course, on our definition. And what I mean is that you gave a few examples of blood sugar ranges being, like, for example, a normal quote unquote fasting 65 to 99. But somebody with a fasting blood sugar of 65 is not the same as somebody who has a fasting blood sugar of 99. And similarly, blood sugars after meals ranging between, say, 100 to 140, somebody who has a postprandial or after meal blood sugar excursion, which is what we're going to call these kind of blood sugar fluctuations, up to 100 in response to a given meal versus up to 140 in a given meal, those are not the same situations physiologically, medically, health-wise. The question, though, is at what degree does risk begin to increase, and therefore, what level should we try to target with these things? I think that, you know, we have various ways of testing people's blood sugar or control, quote-unquote, of their diabetes if they have it. For example, a hemoglobin A1C test gives you just a set percentage number. We describe this oftentimes as being the average blood sugar over the past 3 months, although there are a bunch of variables that can impact the accuracy of that measurement. There are other similar measurements like a fructosamine measurement and other things that sometimes people do. Alternatively, people can do just finger stick, just stick their blood sugar first thing in the morning, get a fasting blood sugar. You can get a plasma blood glucose, drawing it out of a vein first thing in the morning. You can also do oral glucose tolerance tests where you give somebody a glucose-laden drink of a given volume and number of grams of sugar in it, and then you monitor their blood glucose either an hour or 2 hours, whatever, afterwards. Each of those tests give us an imperfect view of the person's physiology as it relates to blood sugar and insulin release. Each of them have different diagnostic kind of cutoffs, but again, all these cutoffs are somewhat arbitrary, meaning that the actual degree of risk that is reflected is a spectrum. It's a continuous spectrum from the, you know, quote unquote normal range all the way up to somebody's blood sugar being fasting 200, 300 plus. It's a continuous spectrum. There's not a level where, you know, for example, at the diagnostic cutoff for diabetes of 126 milligrams per deciliter fasting glucose, a person whose glucose is 125 is not physiologically that different from somebody whose glucose fasting is 126 or 127, but we have to set these cutoffs someplace. So that's kind of like the groundwork that people need to understand as far as why the definition of what a blood sugar spike is so important. But what we're describing with this concept of spikes or glycemic excursions or glycemic variability, these are all terms that if you want to nerd out on this, you can Google or PubMed glycemic excursion, glycemic variability, and they do appear to be independent risk factors for complications, cardiovascular disease complications, other diabetic complications, independent of just your plain old hemoglobin A1C measurement. And an example of why is if somebody's blood sugar's running in the 70s, but then they have a quote unquote spike up to 180, then the average quote unquote between those two extremes might not result in a hemoglobin A1C that is all that high. The lows and the highs can kind of get canceled out, so to speak, and you might have a decent looking hemoglobin A1C. We see this actually quite a lot in patients with type 1 diabetes who are on insulin and their blood sugar tends to fluctuate a whole lot. And when you collapse it all down into a number like a hemoglobin A1C percentage and you see a 6.8 or something like that, or a 6.3, you're like, oh, that A1C looks pretty good. But if you look at their actual blood sugar ranges and excursions and variability, it is all over the place. And that leads to, you know, advice of modification of their therapy or of their diet or of their lifestyle, et cetera, to kind of reduce those excursions, even though their hemoglobin A1C looked okay. Now, there is one situation where I could also make a counterargument to this, that because studies that have looked at interventions specifically to reduce glycemic variability or glycemic excursions are kind of mixed in terms of their impact on results. Not all studies that have looked at reducing these things show a clear benefit on some of these outcomes. The most extreme example, and the one that is the least generalizable to the general population, is research that I cite quite often in my work in the hospital, where they've done studies on patients who are critically ill in an ICU setting. And in those situations, if we try to really tightly control their blood sugars and keep them in that nice tight range of 100 to 140, they actually die more compared to if we let them ride between 140 and 180. But that's obviously a very extreme scenario, but it's just a situation where, you know, it's almost like an exception to this general principle that all blood sugar spikes should be avoided. That's a situation where tightening that control and keeping it lower and in a range that looks prettier actually kills people more often than being a little bit more liberal and letting it ride a little bit higher. So I think that broadly speaking, for the general population, if we define blood sugar excursions or blood sugar quote unquote spikes as after you eat a meal, your blood sugar flies up into the overtly diabetic range. Say your post-meal glucoses are going up to 160, 180, 200 milligrams per deciliter, something like that. I would view that as something that I would prefer not happen. And I would modify diet, lifestyle, medical therapy, et cetera, to improve that control. But this doesn't mean that any increase in blood sugar should be avoided. Because, for example, if somebody goes from 90 to 115 and then comes back down, I don't like the term spike for something like that either. It's kind of like this ominous, threatening word. And that's not something, because people do get pretty neurotic about this, especially if somebody slaps a continuous glucose monitor onto them. And then they just watch it and they're like, if their blood sugar goes up by 5, they're like, oh, I need to stop eating or go run around or something like that to make it come down, which is a level of neurosis that probably causes more harm than it does to extend your lifespan. So ultimately, it's really a matter of definition, but I think the concept is valid, and I would aim to reduce those when possible.
All right. I would like to point out that that was far longer than the allotted 2 minutes, but we're all thankful for you demonstrating your expertise. Nice job. I will have to then take the negative that, you know, blood sugar spikes are not inherently bad or should not be avoided. And the only way I can do that, and you alluded to this, is by changing the definition of what a blood sugar spike is. But that's kind of the whole point, right? If you put out this information that blood sugar spikes are bad, well, you have to define what that is so we all know what you're talking about. And then we can evaluate that claim independently of anything else you're saying. So, you know, what you should do to avoid them, for example. So if someone were to, as you discussed, describe a blood sugar spike as to something greater than, you know, 140 milligrams per deciliter after a meal, or certainly 180 milligrams per deciliter after a meal, as you referenced, a range that is most likely associated with insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, something like that. I think that is not a controversial take to say, yeah, we would avoid that if we got to choose outside of specific settings like critically ill patients. However, when you look at people, individuals without diabetes, there's this other sort of term called time in range. It's effectively where your blood sugar sort of ranges between fasting, postprandial, like you said, after a meal. And you'd want that to be between 70 to 140. And in individuals without diabetes, when they are on continuous blood glucose monitors, they're in that range close to 99% of the time because by definition, they don't have diabetes. And so they are able to control their blood sugar. So I think, you know, unfortunately, when people, particularly in the fitness space, are talking about blood sugar spikes, they're talking about something that goes just above a fasting level. So like 110, avoiding that and keeping it at 100 would be better. That's their prediction. Or making it 110 instead of 120. That's their prediction. And that I do not think is defensible by with existing evidence. If you wanted to make the case that avoiding going over 140 or certainly 180, I think that has pretty good evidence, but it's also not controversial. That's not very sexy. And then to the final point of like how, you know, what should we do with this information? I do not think that there's good evidence for using something like a continuous blood glucose monitor in individuals without insulin resistance to monitor their blood sugar on a sort of very short-term basis after a meal and subsequently alter dietary behaviors to achieve that goal. Meaning that, okay, after this particular type of meal, my blood sugar went to 125. I want it to be down at 105, so I need to change what I'm eating. That has no bearing in my estimation on sort of health outcomes. So to summarize, I agree with your take that if you're defining blood sugar quote spikes as something greater than 180 milligrams per deciliter or even a more tightly controlled one at 140 milligrams per deciliter, I think that's a reasonable sort of claim. But that's not, I think, what people are talking about when they say blood sugar spikes outside of doctors, for example, talking about individuals with diabetes. We're talking about, you know, bro science. It's like, don't let your blood sugar spike at all. And I'm like, that, one, define your terms, and then two, it's probably wrong.
Yeah, I mean, if they wanted to go with that definition, because again, you said, you know, that's not what they're talking about. I don't think they know exactly what they're talking about. But if they were to define it as such, like any, you know, detectable increase above fasting, then there's a lot of implications for that. Like there's a lot of things that you also shouldn't do independent of your diet, like any sort of stimulant use, even exercise can lead to an increase while you do it. You know, if you happen to, you know, wake up early in the morning, restrict your sleep by 30 minutes or an hour, there's going to be a detectable increase in blood sugar as a result of that. Any kind of stress, any, you know, lots of things, because this is a super dynamic thing. And so much like we've talked about with blood lipids and blood pressure, this concept of cumulative lifelong exposure, that also applies here. Like your cumulative lifelong exposure to overall elevations in blood sugar are going to relate to things like cardiovascular risk and various other complications of diabetes. It's just where we set those cutoffs is kind of frustratingly arbitrary because of how our minds work and how tests work, but it is just this kind of graded spectrum. And so if I could get it a bit lower, then I would, but there's also, you know, at the opposite end of the spectrum, like a hemoglobin A1C curve, if you look at those versus mortality, you can have like mortality increases as that gets too low. Of course, the question is, why is it getting so low? Is this person, you know, not eating? Are they malnourished? Or they have cancer or something like that? When I see a hemoglobin A1C of like, you know, I rarely ever see one below 4%. But if I do, I'm like, this person's probably going to die soon. Like, I don't feel great about this.
Optimized.
Yeah. Optimized. So lower is not always better in this situation. But there's a lot of complexity to that too. So,
yeah. All right. Yeah. Good one. All right. So that's question number one. All right. Debate proposition number two. This one has to do with medical school education. So most medical schools organize their training into two parts, preclinical and clinical. In a traditional four-year medical school curriculum, The preclinical phase includes 2 years of in-class education where you learn about basic medical concepts, the structure and functions of the body, diseases, diagnoses, and treatment concepts. And then the second 2 years, so years 3 and 4, are mostly clinical, during which time students receive basic instruction and hands-on experience with patients in the major medical specialties. Concepts pertaining to exercise, though, are largely not taught in medical school. So the debate proposition is as follows. Medical schools should include formal exercise education in their curricula. So I will take the lead on this, and I will respond in the affirmative with the definition of formal exercise education revolving around not only the effects of exercise, but also behavior change sort of counseling to encourage individuals and to facilitate patients to exercise. Because I don't think that we need physicians trained in like how to program or even like how to coach exercise, right? You don't need your physician to like know how to squat or teach a squat or bench press or deadlift. I think that might be useful in some settings where individuals have fear or kinesophobia around particular movements because they can do that in office rather than having to refer out. But at the same time, they just don't have enough time with patients, unfortunately, to really leverage that to a significant degree. So I think a far more useful bit of time in education would be around, well, here's what exercise can do as far as these lifestyle modifications that are widely recommended for virtually for prevention and risk reduction or reducing the burden of disease by basically all national and international health organizations. That's almost universal. But physicians, by and large, are unaware of not only what are the current exercise guidelines, like they just aren't aware of them, but also how to recommend them. And the major implications or major limitations for physicians in recommending exercise to their patients, despite it being, you know, relatively effective when they do so, is that they claim they don't have enough time. They don't have enough knowledge of exercise in and of itself, and they don't personally exercise. So one could make the argument that like actually making physicians exercise during medical school might like at least remove that last point and also be beneficial to the physician's health. Although I don't know that
having PE class in med school,
compulsory exercise or mandatory exercise. I don't know that that's something that most people would get behind, but I do think that familiarizing physicians in training with not only what the current exercise guidelines are, their potential benefits and limitations, potentially some interesting sort of abnormalities that I'll put in quotation marks that people who exercise might often experience. So that way physicians do not discourage individuals from exercising due to some sort of lab abnormality, like, you know, elevated creatinine that you otherwise ferret out or elevated liver transaminases that you otherwise kind of work up. I just think that more knowledge of not only what the sort of minimum level of exercise is or that we're the benchmark that we're looking for to improve health. I think knowledge of that is going to be helpful for communicating with patients. But certainly also the behavior change sort of skills needed to get folks to participate. So that's what I would do if I could add something to the medical curricula. I don't think, again, it's important like the goals of the CrossFit Health MD cert is like, oh, we're going to basically turn you into a personal trainer. It's like, you don't need to have that fund of knowledge. I want, you know, physicians by and large to operate up to their level of training, which is not the same as a strength conditioning coach. There's two separate jobs for two different reasons. But, you know, one could argue that having a referral network might be advantageous for patients with means and resources. So I respond in the affirmative. I'll be curious to see how you respond in the negative here.
Yeah, as usual, being forced to take an uncomfortable position. So I'll say that no, doesn't need to include this. And I think you similarly alluded to the way that I'll come at this at the end of your response there, in that I'm thinking about this through the lens of, you know, scope of practice or levels of care is kind of another concept. So for example, you know, if somebody is so sick that they need a level of care that is in the critical care unit in the ICU, that has certain implications for who should be taking care of them and what should be done in that context, right? So nobody is going to be, you know, talking about increasing their dietary fiber intake long-term for cardiovascular risk when they're in septic shock in the ICU, right? That's not the appropriate kind of level of care or forum for that sort of intervention. And so when it comes to physicians working with patients, they have a lot that they are responsible for, especially in the primary care setting. It's arguably easier for specialists who are being consulted for just like one organ system or one issue. But for primary care, there is an enormous amount that you are responsible for, from people's physical health and long-term preventative care and mental health, and then all the other things that existing medical conditions that they may come in with. And of course, it is true that many of them may be impacted beneficially by exercise, but the amount of time and effort that would be required for a physician to comprehensively integrate exercise into the treatment plan for their patient is unrealistic in modern practice, I think. I think lots of people who view this as a very like obvious, attractive thing that should be widely deployed all over the place, two things. One, they don't really have a ton of understanding of what modern primary care or medical practice realistically looks like. And the other is, I think a lot of them who really have strong, strong opinions about this are also the types of people who already exercise and enjoy exercise, and for them exercise is very enjoyable. And so that's their hammer for everything. And of course, yes, I'm, you know, both of us are big evangelists for exercise as far as how it can benefit a lot of health conditions. But again, the realities of integrating this into modern medical practice with a patient population who does not love exercise as much as you do, is not as readily ready to take it up and have access and all that sort of stuff, makes it so that there are many situations where that primary care office visit is probably not the appropriate level of care for that sort of intervention to take place in a very, very detailed way, right? I would love if it were the case that every primary care appointment you could have, you know, 45 minutes, an hour, even more if you needed it, to go into this stuff in great detail if it's something that you're comfortable with. And sometimes, you know, there are places, cash practices, direct pay, you know, direct primary care kind of stuff that do have that access, but that's not realistic in a lot of places. And so I think that, you know, as far as the physician's scope of practice, what are the things that only they can do for the patient? We should prioritize those things first. And then insofar as exercise has an important role to play in the care of their patient's conditions, there are a lot of people out there who can offer that within their scope of practice and at a slightly different quote unquote level of care. We already see this with dietitians, right? So, you know, a lot of clinics have integrated registered dietitians. We have dietitians in the hospital. And so where you might have even an endocrinologist who manages diabetes all day, every day in their clinic, they are probably not spending enormous amounts of time on detailed nutritional counseling because there are a lot of things related to diabetes and the medical conditions that can emerge from it and interact with it that they have to be juggling. And for the dietetics piece, they have somebody specialized in dietetics who can handle that piece in the clinic. Is that the best way for these sorts of care models? I don't know. But I think that it's kind of the reality nowadays in terms of specialization, fractionalization of care in this way. And so you could see similarly kind of like an exercise physiologist or something like that. Again, that is not necessarily ideal because the patient might have three appointments instead of one. But that's unfortunately, like I said, the way things are right now. So I agree with your former premise that like, yeah, awareness, super important. Brief interventions from a physician are probably more effective than people think in terms of just giving some basic advice. But detailed counseling, programming, troubleshooting, you know, people's exercise programs and things like that, I don't think that the physician is the appropriate level of care for that intervention to be done in most modern medical practices.
My rebuttal is that it seems like you're agreeing with me, so I cede the rest of my time.
All right. Fair enough.
It does not interact with my statement. Okay. Next debate proposition. All right. Muscle is an adaptive tissue that responds to what is repeatedly asked of it. In response to an exercise program that's appropriate for the individual, that is, uses the correct load, volume, range of motion, proximity to failure, and so on, if it's well suited to the individual, yeah, muscles can improve force production in specific tasks, which is strength, and increase in size, which is hypertrophy. Now, one common claim that goes back over half a century is that free weight-based training improves strength and hypertrophy more than machine-based training. According to the functional fitness paradigm, quote, functional exercises improve strength more than, quote, non-functional movements. Presumably, non-functional movements would refer to those that are machine-based and or those that use single joint movements. The debate proposition is as follows. Barbell exercises are more functional than machines. Austin, you get the lead here.
I'm going to respond in the negative and say they are not more functional than machines. I think that barbells are just as arbitrary as any other implement for applying resistance to the body. They are a tool that we can use to load particular movements in particular ways. But if I just say I have an implement that loads the body in a particular way, you could literally use anything under the sun and it would effectively deliver a stimulus to the body. Then the question is, how are we testing our outcome? because I heard two claims be made in that preamble. One is that they improve strength more than non-barbell movements. And in that way, we have to define how are we testing strength, right? So if the test of strength is going to be on a barbell movement, then the barbell movement would be expected to increase strength more. If the test of strength is on a machine movement, then the machine movement would. And if the test of strength is some completely different non-barbell, non-machine type movement, then it's kind of a coin flip. You don't really know. There's probably a lot more variables that will interact to lead to that outcome based on the person's advantages and disadvantages at training those tasks. So that's as it relates to the strength claim. As far as this functional claim, kind of like our first question where we didn't have a great definition of what a blood glucose spike was, here we don't really have a great definition of what functional is. A lot of people will make claims, for example, that, hey, you'll need to squat in your real life and pick things up in your real life, and therefore, as a result, barbell movements are more functional than machines. But, you know, a belt squat is a machine, and a belt squat is just as much of a loaded squatting type movement as a barbell is. And I see no significant reason why one would be more or less functional than the other if you found yourself needing to squat regularly in day-to-day life. So I think, you know, a lot of this comes down to a matter of definition. How are you defining a functional exercise? But ultimately, you know, the test of strength, the test of function, in terms of how you're assessing it is really what I would view as the thing that matters here. And I have little reason or evidence, more importantly, to believe that one or the other is going to lead to significantly better outcomes in an unrelated test or task.
All right. So you took the affirmative that the negative that barbell exercises are not more, quote, functional than machine-based exercises. So I'm forced to take the affirmative. I do not disagree that both machine-based and free weight-based exercises provide similar outcomes when tested. So hypertrophy outcomes are the same if you test strength on the way that things are being trained during the program, they're likely to also be the same, meaning the magnitude of improvement in a Smith machine squat is going to be the same as the magnitude of improvement from a free weight squat. No arguments there. I would agree with your take on that 100%. As you alluded to, the issue here in the premise is that what does functional actually mean, right? And so because there's no agreed upon definition of what functional training actually is, you kind of have to make one up. And so I get to make one up that agrees with my sort of affirmation that barbell and free weight exercises are more functional than machine-based exercises. So if you define functional fitness or functional exercises as those that focus on using strength training to improve things like balance, coordination, muscular strength, and endurance that are important for either activities of sport or daily living, then I think you could make an argument that free weight-based exercises are likely better for doing that than machine-based exercises because there are more degrees of freedom in the free weight exercise. The balance component is kind of unique to most free weight exercises compared to most machine-based exercises. To your point, I don't think the single joint exercise sort of caveat here really, you know, makes a difference. For example, like isolation exercises, if you're do a dumbbell curl and you improve the strength and function of the biceps, like that seems pretty functional for using the biceps in some sort of manner. But the balance component is what I'd kind of have to focus on to make this, to support this claim. And I don't know that that is how most people would actually define functional fitness. So it's tough to argue this without a formalized consensus definition of what functional is. And I think if gun to my head, I would actually agree that there's no real difference in not only health outcomes, but also like strength and hypertrophy outcomes from using machines versus free weights, provided you're testing those outcomes in a way that is not, you know, too disparate from how you're actually training them. It's just a specificity of adaptation to impose demand, the said principle kind of playing out in real life.
My counter to that is just going to have to rely on the fact that that position is purely speculative. In other words, I'm not aware of any evidence actually comparing free weight versus machine-based training and looking at some sort of validated balance outcome, for example. It seems intuitive, and there are probably some people listening who are rolling their eyes saying, well, duh, it's obvious that if you did something that requires the free weights are going to improve your balance more. And, there have been a lot of times throughout history when people have said, look, it's obvious that this is going to be the answer. And then when it's actually tested, we find out that not as much of a difference as was intuited. And so it's a speculative conclusion. I think, you know, we both have even made such a claim before that it seems that free weights would challenge balance and therefore lead to better improvements in that particular outcome. But I would temper that by saying, I don't know that to be the case. Is it possible that you take, you know, an older person with some sort of neurodegenerative disease, Parkinson's disease or something like that, and you leg press them or belt squat them for a while compared to a barbell squat, and then you end up seeing both groups improving equally on a balance-related task? I find that to be a very plausible potential outcome. It would just have to be tested to strengthen our confidence.
Yeah, you could actually predict that people might do better in that situation on a machine-based training because they actually train harder.
Because they can train. Yes, they're not as limited. But yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so it would be interesting to see that in a lot of different studies because I know that there are studies on this. There's just not a lot. And then when you look at the data, it's kind of all over the place, which makes you kind of do shoulder shrug emoji and have to get speculative. So yeah, big surprise. We actually end up agreeing at the end of all this. Again, this is Great Debates number 5. I'm here with Dr. Austin Baraki. Next debate proposition has to do with everybody's favorite topic, health misinformation. All right, so misinformation and disinformation involve the spread of non-factual information. The distinguishing feature between the two terms is intention. Misinformation refers to the distribution of false information without the intention to cause harm and encompasses health misinformation, which involves making health-related claims that are not based on scientific evidence without intending to cause harm. Now, in contrast, the motive for disinformation is to deliberately cause harm by sharing false information. Misinformation, disinformation, and fake news are not new, but in the era of social media, pretty much anyone can put out content regardless of its accuracy. So the debate proposition is as follows. Combating health misinformation on social media works. And I think I have to take the lead on this?
Go for it.
Okay. I will respond in the affirmative, but again, this is a definition issue. Works, a lot of heavy lifting in this debate proposition. So I would say that I would define works, and we can use this as like a working definition, that that means it is a I just had a stroke, like a full-on motor stroke. I would say that works in this case means that it's better to combat misinformation rather than just let it go. And I don't think that means you necessarily convince the person who's saying the things that they're incorrect and they should retract or redact their statement. But I think rather what I mean is that when people see this, quote, misinformation, they need to see a rebuttal somewhere there as well in order to like not let that information go on undeterred, unfettered, otherwise unopposed. And to the extent that people are actually reading the comments or like kind of digging into this further, I think having that is better than not having it. Ultimately, I think it makes little effect on the person making the claims or those who already believe those claims or who in the tribes of people who believe those claims. I don't think you can really get much purchase there, get much buy-in there. But to the people who are on the fence, maybe, for example, I think you would predict there would be better outcomes for individuals who haven't quite made a decision on how they feel about something. And further, for folks who are heavily entrenched in the evidence-based sort of world, when they see somebody kind of fighting back, that also like gives some sort of support to, hey, keep fighting the good fight, keep doing the thing. And I think all of those are better outcomes than sort of just letting stuff just go on, the lie traveling halfway around the world before the truth gets its pants on. Like we need some help in this phase. Ideally, you would have this combating of health misinformation happening further upstream, like before the publication of the misinformation, or like in primary education where people learn how to think, what is critical thinking, and like how to assess information and come to conclusions. But yeah, in the era of social media, it's going to be difficult to do things upstream. So overall, my take is that it's probably better to combat health misinformation in a way that is consistent with being an honest broker of information. So that means not a zealot, not an advocate or whatever, but just by providing the correct information as we see it based on scientific evidence, making appropriate caveats to the limitations of the current knowledge. That would be my take.
Okay. So I'll have to say this doesn't work, which is kind of my gut instinct kind of anyway, in a sense, although, I agree that it's like kind of worth the effort to try in some cases, but I'm not super optimistic about its efficacy, which is really the heart of this question. And the way I'm thinking about it that way is this is fundamentally getting at belief change. And in order to talk about belief change, you have to kind of understand how beliefs form in the first place. And I don't have time to get into all of that in great detail. But once again, for probably the dozenth time on this podcast, I'll recommend people read the book How Minds Change by Dave McCraney. It's fantastic and really gets at this topic. And so once you get through that book and you learn about this, you have a much better sense of how beliefs form, where they come from. And then as a result of that, you have a better sense of how should I even approach this if my aim is to change belief. And I think that, you know, if we're aiming to combat health misinformation to change people's beliefs, I think it's just we're firing in the wrong direction. We're firing in a direction that does not actually target or get at the person's reasons for establishing the belief in the first place. That is a very lengthy way, much like the Paracelsus quote we pulled on a couple previous episodes of you can't reason your way out of a position that you didn't reason yourself into. So I think that it's really difficult to facilitate belief change because it's such an individual level phenomenon. Social media makes it even more difficult because there's this two-way street of people siloing themselves into their own echo chambers and then algorithms further reinforcing those same echo chambers. So like most of our listeners here are not going to be the types of people whose minds we're like super, super interested in changing because they've self-selected to listen to us here for the most part. There may be some beliefs here and there that get challenged among the listeners, but by and large, we're not like, you know, completely reprogramming people's minds around health information just by listening to this podcast. A lot of them were open to what we had to say and would be less inclined to go to somebody who takes, you know, firmly opposing beliefs, like go to the carnivore podcast and put equal weight on that in their own, you know, careful, rational weighing of evidence to come to a conclusion, which is just fundamentally not how most people's beliefs form. And so if it were just a matter of delivering information that is evidence-based and, you know, not clearly biased, slanted, as a zealot, as you said, and people's belief and buy-in would follow, then I think combating it publicly in that way would be expected to be pretty effective. But I think since that's not how most of these beliefs form in the first place, combating it is far less likely to be effective, in my opinion.
Yeah. If I had to rebut this, I would just not, because I ultimately think that you're right. I think that, again, the term works, you know, here is really what you'd have to define. Like, how are you measuring this working? And I have, you know, I'm relatively pessimistic that even if you go through great lengths to combat misinformation, you're an excellent science communicator, you're charismatic, you're engaging, kind, like whatever, I still don't think ultimately it really moves the needle for people who have already made up their minds. And if that's how you're defining works, well, yeah, I think that's going to be a tough hill to climb. If it's people on the fence, might be more effective, and it's people who already like agree with you, well, then what did you, you didn't need to do this in the first place. So tough times.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned, and I still agree that it's not wise to let all that junk be out there unopposed. And so in that way, it's like, perhaps at least it is keeping people appraised of the fact that there might be controversy around something mm-hmm. instead of leaving it completely unchecked. But rather, if the idea of it works is like, we're actually changing tons of minds out there, I think that's far less likely to, you know, be a thing that happens.
Yeah, agreed. All right, we'll come back to the rest of the great debates, number five, here after this break. For all the golfers in the audience, you've probably heard of PXG by seeing them on the PGA Tour in the hands of guys like Joel Damon, Zach Johnson, and Luke List. Well, they're bringing that same passion for excellence to their new line of apparel, and I gotta say, they nailed it. I just got another polo from them, and both the fit and performance are excellent. They're really versatile as well, meaning I can wear them out to eat or take a meeting without signaling to everyone that I'm about to play golf. PXG apparel has something for everyone. They got pants, polos, sweaters, hats, quarter zips, joggers, jackets, skirts, everything you could want. I've got a few of their hats and a few of their polos, but some of their mid-layers look great too. We've got a special offer for our audience. If you're looking to elevate your style game on and off the course, check out the PXG Spring and Summer 2024 collections. Head over to pxg.com/barbell and use the code BARBELL at checkout to save 10% on all apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. That's code BARBELL to save 10% on apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of the questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys. All right, we're back here with Dr. Austin Baracchi. Great debates number 5. This one is on PED use and whether or not what should be legalized. Okay, PED use, performance-enhancing drug use in sports, has been going on ever since they were created. This is not a modern phenomenon, as they were even used before they were synthesized in a lab. And athletes have tried to get an advantage. Current estimates suggest pretty widespread use in sport, maybe 29% of individuals. For example, in a 2011 track and field world championships, they admitted to use of PED within the last year, and 45% of individuals in a Pan-Arab Games also admitted to using PEDs within the last year. And even in non-competitive athletes, use is common, with some survey data showing that close to 3/4 of men in the gym have used anabolic steroids at least once in their life, typically at high doses. Now, PEDs come in many forms, from widely available legal agents like caffeine, that's technically a performance-enhancing drug. However, most people probably think about PEDs as being steroids or similar agents. And in most areas, these are illegal to use or possess without a prescription. So the debate proposition is as follows. PEDs should be legalized. Austin, you get to take the lead on this.
Okay. This is, I don't know, perhaps surprisingly, a topic that I don't have a super strong opinion on, or perhaps a super well thought out opinion on. So I'm admittedly making something up here. And so I'll take the affirmative that sure, they should be legal. And the main, there's a couple ways that I can think about this. One is that their illegality clearly has not stopped a large swath of the population from using them. That is admittedly the same argument that's used for a lot of other drug decriminalization efforts, which have had varying degrees of success around the world, some more successful than others and some not particularly successful. So even that is a bit of a mixed bag. The other aspect is that there two prongs here. The illegality of them makes it so that people are less open about their use from a medical or a health context. And so they are less likely to be appropriately monitored for health-related complications and more likely to experience harms from these things, as we've talked about before. And so perhaps you could make an argument that if they were at least not criminalized, that a person or a patient might be more willing or open to discuss this with a physician for appropriate monitoring that we talked about on a recent episode as well. And then the last one is that because they're illegal and banned in sport and all of this, and that drug testing is instituted, it's led to basically an arms race of evasion. And so the arms race of trying to evade these drug tests leads to more and more complex, quote unquote, designer drug kind of molecules and things like that, that are even less and less and less well characterized in terms of our understanding of how they can impact people's physiology. And a lot of them have great potential for harm. And so I think that these are some of the downside, the negative consequences of these substances being criminalized or being illegal. It, you know, in my mind and how I imagine you'll come at this is similarly, a lot of that is speculative in some ways, and also that just because a large swath of the population has managed to use them despite them being, you know, illegal, that does not mean that if they were legalized that tons and tons more people wouldn't use them and then also experience more and more harms. Like the net harm may be greater with greater use just because of a, you know, greater N there, which is a plausible outcome. But so it's ultimately like where your non-evidence-based gut sense is for the balance between risks and harms. And so I listed at least 3 potential downsides of them being criminalized or illegal at this time. So do with that what you will.
Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree with your take, you know, so your thought is that they should be legalized to avoid those potential downsides, which I think has reasonable evidence in other settings, you know, for drug decriminalization in general, although this is not a political podcast, so we'll kind of avoid going into that further.
Nor do we claim great expertise in that realm anyway. 100%. So my positions are not strong there.
100%. So I think, you know, if I have to take the opposite view on this, that PD should remain illegal, I think I would actually soften my take and say that I think some regulation for controlled substances is warranted. However, being a Schedule One substance or something like that not only maybe unfairly stigmatizes these agents, but also limits research into them and clearly has not dissuaded use. So if the prediction that like completely legalizing them would increase use, I don't know that that's the case, because the stigmatization around these things already is probably is a deterrent to people who are, you know, not, you know, wouldn't otherwise use them. And the people who are going to use them, they don't care about the legal ramifications by and large. But I do think some regulation is probably useful in order to monitor people's use on this so they don't do it under the cloak of secrecy, to maybe stop the arms race for like new and novel agents that we don't really know what they do. And also this sort of black market creation of these agents. You know, most of the anabolics that are used in sport are not produced by like pharmaceutical companies anymore, or at least not done so in large amounts. And so people are making these in non, you know, pharmaceutical grade settings, the bathtub brew, as I often refer to it as. You know, that's the idea that somebody in their house is like brewing up a bunch of testosterone in their bathtub and then packaging it and like, yeah, dude, it's good. And you're like, are you sure? Yeah. So I think, you know, I'd be in favor of some regulation, but on a lower level that would otherwise increase access to folks who choose to use these things, which I think is a reasonable thing to do under guidance and, you know, while actively weighing the risks and benefits with some professional insight. I just think that the way they're currently regulated has not really led to the outcomes we want, which is less use, you know, better health, whether it's in sport or in non-competitive athletes. And you know, some change needs to be made. I would just sort of advocate for a level of regulation. This is kind of analogous to the idea that, oh, statin should be available over the counter, right? And it's like, well, the risks are relatively low, and you could make an argument that stuff like aspirin or, you know, even ibuprofen, Tylenol, whatever, do also have like a toxicity profile that is, you know, non-zero. And so you could make an argument, oh, statin should be over the counter. Like they're pretty, pretty good. But I don't know that I feel the same for anabolic agents in general. I just think that the physiological effects are a little too powerful and the potential risks are a little too high to just be out there in the world without some sort of, I don't know, regulation at any level.
Yeah, I think that regulation as opposed to outright legality or illegality as a like a hard binary thing with a lot of like criminal related consequences and outcomes is, I think that the concept of regulation makes a lot more sense. It's just that those regulations need to be altered. Agree that the Schedule One nature of them does not make a ton of sense among several other substances on that on that list. So
yeah, agreed. All right, next question. This has to do with protein, your favorite. It has long been said that dietary protein is the most satiating or filling macronutrient, leading to reduced calorie intake compared to an equivalent amount of calories coming from carbohydrates or fat. According to conventional theory, increased protein intake is said to increase feelings of fullness or satiety via hormonal signals and increased energy expenditure, among others. The debate proposition is as follows. People should eat more than 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day for improved satiety. And I will lead this off and I will respond in the negative, that people should not eat more than 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day for improved satiety. And my rationale for this is as follows. While there's a ton of data out there showing that protein at a particular meal increases ratings of satiety directly after that meal, those ratings do not correspond with decreased energy intake throughout the next meal or the entire day. Further, there's additional evidence showing that, yes, hormones released from the gut that are involved in satiety, those go up with higher levels of protein, but they do not correspond with decreased energy intake over the whole day or subsequently weeks, months, etc. There's also good evidence that increasing protein intake increases blood levels of various amino acids that have been associated with increased satiety. This is called the immunostatic theory. However, fasting levels of amino acids do not correspond with appetite, and increased levels of blood amino acid levels also do not correspond with decreased energy intake throughout the rest of the day, subsequent days, weeks, and so on. There are multiple other mechanisms that people have postulated by which protein can increase satiety, thereby leading to better sort of weight loss outcomes and so on. The main other one having to do with better support of muscle mass, whether it's muscle mass preservation, muscle mass growth, and so on, particularly during periods of deficit. All of that is true. However, there seems to be a tipping point around 1.2 to 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day, that going above that does not lead to further benefit of those outcomes, of those mechanisms, and of the sort of results that we're really looking at, which again is better body weight management, better body fat, body composition management, and better support of muscle mass during periods of deficit or during growth. So I think here, because there is a specific number, I can respond relatively confidently that adding more protein to that is not likely to improve sort of satiety ratings and subsequent outcomes relating to feelings of fullness. If somebody wanted to eat more protein, that's fine. It's just a personal preference for their dietary pattern, but not necessarily, I don't think it's likely that that improves satiety to a level that otherwise helps control people's energy intake or resting energy expenditure in a way that affects body weight, body composition, or muscle-related outcomes. So I feel relatively confident that that is an evidence-based position to hold with respect to protein intake and satiety.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you did a fair amount of homework for that question, leaving me with not a ton of room to counter. Nor is this an area that I have a great deal of expertise in terms of having read a lot of the evidence base. Just for the audience familiarize themselves with a couple terms, just to be clear on this concept of satiety, that describes feelings of fullness that persist after a meal. So in other words, like between meal feelings of fullness. And that's a little bit different than this concept called satiation, which is the feelings of satisfaction or fullness that lead you to actually stop eating within a meal. So within versus between meals. These are some concepts in like the appetite kind of regulation literature, I suppose, if you want to use that admittedly also controversial term. So the claims you made and the evidence that you cited all make quite a bit of sense to me. The only way that I could find to disagree and say that people should eat more than this for improved satiety is through the lens of food replacement. In other words, not protein, increasing protein for the sake of it to increase satiety, but rather if that increase in protein is replacing other foods that themselves fail to induce this a similar amount of satiety. So if you have basically some kind of high fat, sugar, salt, junk food that is engineered to be, you know, minimally satiating, meaning that it leads you to not ever feel full and you could eat it all day, every day, then replacing that food with an additional dose of some sort of, you know, healthy protein source, that is an argument that I could make that would probably lead to some better outcomes as far as, be it, you know, appetite, body weight regulation, body fat, et cetera. But that's a distinct scenario than just saying that you should crank up the protein for the sake of it. This is more invoking a replacement effect. This is a protein intake compared to what? And I think that comparing these different types of foods, there's a plausible argument there.
Yeah, actually, so my rebuttal is that I fully agree that, in fact, the most powerful mechanism, I think, with respect to increasing dietary protein intake and its subsequent effect on appetite, satiety, and body weight related outcomes is through the lens of food replacement. That if you counsel somebody to increase dietary protein, or if you force somebody to increase dietary protein, they subsequently eat less of other stuff that is not as satiating otherwise, but due to its complex features as a food. So the orosensory sort of components, like how does it feel in the mouth? How does it stimulate emotional reward, things of that nature? And that's due to added sugar, added salt, you know, historical experience, things of all, you know, complex sort of things having to do with the experience of eating. But yeah, in fact, if somebody asked me what is the most powerful mechanism by which increasing dietary protein, quote, works to aid in sort of body weight management, I think it's through the lens of food replacement. It just displaces other foods that you would likely overeat or otherwise are not very healthy self-promoting by themselves, because the average American eats quite a bit of protein. You know, the RDA, they advise eat 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram total body weight per day to not become protein insufficient, right? But most Americans eat about 1.1 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day. But that's a low-quality diet, right? The most common three like protein-related foods are whole chicken, cold cuts, and mixed meat dishes, having mostly to do with pasta, for example. So if you replace that with like lean chicken breast or a whey protein intake or lean fish or something like that, it's like, wow, that's an improvement, and also likely displaces higher calorie foods, particularly those that are not as satiating for the amount of calories that they provide, and potentially some ultra processed foods that are really not very satiating at all. So yeah.
Agree. Oh,
nice. All right, next question. This has to do with the interference effect. So strength, combining strength training and aerobic training together. Over three decades ago, Dr. Robert Hickson observed impaired strength development in previously untrained males who incorporated both strength and endurance workouts into a 10-week training program. Hickson named the impaired gains he observed with concurrent training as the interference effect. The debate proposition is as follows. You can't optimize strength and conditioning at the same time. Austin?
Okay, so I'm going to take the affirmative here that I agree you cannot optimize strength and conditioning at the same time, really just hinging on the fact that the word optimize was included in the debate proposition. It's something that feels pretty obvious on its face, but I'll just discuss a little bit. The physiologic demands of optimizing strength, which, again, we've talked about definitions of strength and how we're going to test strength. All of that is details. But let's say we're optimizing for one rep max strength in a given, you know, resisted loaded activity, and conditioning, meaning like aerobic endurance for like a pretty long effort, would be, we'll take those as the extremes of the spectrum. The physiologic demands of those tasks is very disparate. And there are, in fact, kind of interfering physiologic mechanisms and adaptations between the two. This has been characterized all the way down to the molecular level of how some of the more strength anabolic force producing kind of adaptations will have some inhibitory effect on some of like the mitochondrial biogenesis pathways for aerobic metabolism and vice versa. So this is definitely a thing when we're at the level of optimizing strength and conditioning, right? So if this were to be refuted, you know, I would want to see evidence of somebody, for example, winning Olympic gold in weightlifting, and then like, you know, the next week going to the other Olympic competition and winning the Olympic marathon or something like that. It is not possible to optimize these things. Now, the more useful question, I suppose, is like in terms of its applicability to the general population, people who are listening to us right now for the most part. And because I think at that level, concerns over the interference effect are majorly overblown. And I would also add the additional layer here that most people's priorities are probably not entirely right as far as strength and conditioning training goes. We have obviously an audience that biases towards strength training and probably under conditioning. And then if you go to another podcast, they'd be super into conditioning and then maybe under strength training and worrying about interference effect in the other direction. And so if we're talking about it at the level of general population trainees aiming to be, you know, lean, healthy, active, et cetera, I think you can get very far in strength training and very far in aerobic development at that level without really experiencing major detriments to your adaptations on either side. Particularly, you know, the preamble here described a 10-week training program study. We're talking about over months and years of consistent training. I think it's very feasible to train and adapt to tolerate a fair amount of strength training and a fair amount of conditioning without a major degree of interference. I think both of us do it on a regular basis. We do quite a lot of conditioning, quite a lot of strength training, and have done fine. Not to say that that automatically means everyone can do it, but I think that broadly speaking, people can tolerate a lot more than they think. And then last thing I'll mention here, as far as the general population goes, is for those people who are extremely concerned about not getting as strong as they possibly can because of a little bit of conditioning, for example, or conversely, not getting as aerobically fit as they possibly can because of a little strength training, I think it is probably more likely that they're going to not get as strong as they possibly can or not get as conditioned as they possibly can for other reasons than that. Namely, missing sessions, inconsistency, poor sleep habits, injuries, setbacks, time off, vacations, right? And so if you are going to like align your your identity, align your all of your training efforts to getting as strong as you possibly can, this has a lot more implications than just say, I'm not going to do too much conditioning or something like that. It, you know, and so I think people miss the forest for the trees when they think about things that way.
Yeah. So if I'm forced to take the opposing view, as to be clear, I don't disagree with most of what you said, but yeah. If I have to take the opposing view that you could optimize strength and conditioning at the same time, I have to kind of manufacture a straw man argument here. So you mentioned the scenario where someone would win an Olympic weightlifting, you know, gold medal, and then, sometime right after that, win an Olympic marathon medal. And I would say that, you know, individuals self-select into sport and likely have more robust adaptations to a particular type of training. That's why they ended up in the sport. I don't know that that's a great representative example. However, to your point, if we were using that framework, performance in a validated test of strength and a validated test of conditioning, you could make the argument that someone could max out their hand grip strength and max out their VO2 max development simultaneously. And the reason for that isn't because you know, strength and conditioning don't have any sort of opposing effects or resource limited related effects, but because those are not great tests of strength and conditioning.
Yeah.
Meaning that hand grip strength, yeah, it's just the intrinsic hand muscles, doesn't really proportionally increase with sort of one rep max strength, for example. VO2 max, while it does correlate with endurance performance, there is sort of an upper limit where increasing VO2 max further or even changes in it further do not predict more performance, because performance is more complicated than just a single lab variable. So you could come at it from that angle and maybe support it with some decent evidence. Overall, though, I think that the interference effect is more of a concern in the strength training community than in the endurance community. The data on the interference effect within through the lens of like wanting to maximize conditioning is that, well, shoot, resistance training seems to help. Like, you should definitely do it if you wanted to maximize conditioning performance. You just wouldn't want to do too much of it so where it impairs the resources that you have to train, meaning that it takes up too much training time so you can't participate in all of the conditioning activity that you need to do and further your recovery resources. But on the flip side, if you wanted to maximize strength as defined by like a powerlifting meet performance or whatever, well, by the same token, you can't spend all your time doing conditioning because that's not gonna work out very well either. So ultimately, I tend to agree with the points that you made. I think optimize is the issue here. And if you test those by ways that people actually think about optimal performance, it's probably unlikely you could support this with evidence. You'd have to manufacture a different definition, which I did. And I feel like that's also valid.
The only thing I heard there, I'm not so sure that the concerns about the interference effect are greater in the strength training world than in the conditioning world. If I think about, I know and interact with a fair number of, you know, cyclists, for example. And if you talk much about any significant strength training, like lifting a weight beyond, you know, 85 pounds or something, then there's automatically some concerns about size and weight and being on the bike and things like that. So I think that, you know, I don't obviously have evidence to support this, but I think it's like at beyond a certain level of like, you know, focus on your goal outcome, either in the aerobic, you know, conditioning world or above a certain level in the strength training world, I think that both probably have pretty similar degrees of concern about interference just in opposing directions. And then below that level of like focus on your effort, you just have general population people who are like, I don't know shit about anything. I'm just going to do both and or do neither and not worry about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think my exposure into the conditioning world is definitely biased by people who I actually value their opinion.
Right.
So, like high level coaches, evidence-based people who work with high level athletes. And in general, whether it's cycling, whether it's running, whether it's a multimodal sort of endurance events, so triathlons and such, they pretty much all universally recommend strength training to improve performance, also injury risk reduction and so on. On the flip side, people who are very prolific in the strength training community do not, by the same token, recommend conditioning exercise. Some do, certainly, but a lot of people say, no, you can't do that because, you know, it's going to affect recovery or it's going to make you slow or whatever. And it's kind of like, there's a threshold dose probably to this, and it has to do with more with an individual's level of fitness.
Yeah.
All right. Question number 8. This has to do with, again, another favorite topic of yours, conventional versus sumo. So exercise selection is defined as the specific activities or movements performed by the individual and their specific range of motion, tempo, and style. Now, exercise selection is important when it comes to predicting fitness adaptations from the training program, and this is characterized by the specificity of adaptation to imposed demand, or the SED principle, which suggests that the main adaptations developed from exercise are most specific to the training performed. Now, some have claimed that the conventional deadlift is superior to the sumo deadlift for improving strength, hypertrophy, and health. The debate proposition is as follows. The conventional deadlift is better than the sumo deadlift for strength. So I will have to take the lead here, and I will respond in the negative that the conventional deadlift is not better than the sumo deadlift for strength. And this is the, you know, same thing we've repeated all the time. It just depends how you're testing strength. If you're testing strength in the sumo deadlift, for example, a sumo deadlift one rep max, well, no shit. Training the sumo deadlift is going to be superior to the conventional deadlift for the vast majority of individuals at improving strength as measured by that. If you're testing strength in a unrelated way, like the leg press, for example, you don't really know. You could make a bunch of speculative predictions based on how similar the joint angles are for particular movements and how closely they relate. And you would predict that the more similar the joint angles, the muscle lengths, the movement pattern is from one exercise to another, that you'd see a better transference. All right. But that's admittedly speculative and varies widely between individuals. I think when people say that the conventional deadlift is better is that they're saying that it transfers over better to more activities than the sumo deadlift. But I think that's relatively short-sighted. Yes, the conventional deadlift probably transfers over better to things like a clean, for example, or maybe a snatch. You're again, speculative, but the similar joint angles and setup and such, that all kind of makes sense to me. But I would say, well, the sumo deadlift transfers over better to like lifting a stone, for example, or picking up things between your legs, you know, something like that. And so I just think ultimately when you're talking about one exercise being better for strength, and if you would say general strength, I think all you're doing at that point is speculating, and to the best of your abilities, you can predict what exercise is going to do better based on the similarities between the exercise that you're doing and the task and how similar those things are.
Yeah, I agree. It's a nonsensical proposition, and I don't really feel like it requires a ton more discussion. I think one of the amusing things that I think about is, you know, this is a position that's held pretty strongly by some of our former colleagues from years back with whom we would vehemently disagree on this proposition. And so there's like an interesting kind of train of logic that you can think through if you wanted to try to apply something like that to this, right? So, you know, I remember their criteria having to do with, you know, things like range of motion and weight on the bar and things like that. And right off the bat, you have seemingly conflicting answers based on their own criteria for exercise selection, right? So if you were prioritizing range of motion and you made the argument that because the range of motion of the conventional deadlift is better than the sumo deadlift, well, then I would make the argument that you should probably deficit deadlift, because then the deficit deadlift is going to offer more range of motion. But then their counter to that would be, well, no, not the deficit deadlift, because then you have to use less weight. It's like, well, if weight is the priority, a fair amount of people are probably going to be able to sumo deadlift more than they can conventional deadlift. And so then suddenly the pendulum has swung back in the direction of sumo deadlifting. These are not 100%, you know, general across the entire population, but it's this rigid adherence to just admittedly arbitrary exercises like a barbell deadlift, which has extremely arbitrary range of motion based on the arbitrary made up Olympic plate diameter of 45 centimeters or whatever it is, right? If you said, no, you can't deficit deadlift because it's a longer range of motion and you have to use less weight. Well, it's like, what if, you know, 100, whatever number of years ago, somebody decided that instead of 45 centimeter plates, we're going to use 40 centimeter plates. And then all along we would have been deadlifting with what is now effectively a deficit deadlift height. And you'd be using an analogous amount of weight. It's literally all made up. So that is, all of those things are reasons why I view this as just a nonsensical proposition that's like not even worth engaging anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you have multiple criteria, right? And then that you've made up, and then you're like trying to come up with something reasonable, like a reasonable compromise between all of them. But it's all, at the end of the day, you started making it up and it's still made up. And so it's like, what are you talking about? Just like define your outcomes and then we can assess, you know, the veracity of the claim. Yeah. But, you know, if you arrived at a conclusion by making it up, it'd be really hard to like unconvince yourself, to your earlier point. Okay. Second to last question here. This is on ultra processed foods. Now, ultra-processed foods use many ingredients, including food additives and ingredients rarely used in home food preparation. Also, industrialized processing to improve palatability and preservation. Things like sweetened cereals, pastries, pre-prepared meat, pasta, pizza dishes, chips, etc. are all examples of ultra-processed foods. In the US and UK, over 55% of the average daily energy intake now comes from ultra-processed foods and are becoming increasingly more prevalent in the diets of infants, children, and adolescents. From a health standpoint, the 2021 American Heart Association's scientific statement on dietary guidance to improve cardiovascular outcomes recommends that individuals choose minimally processed foods instead of ultra-processed foods as one of the 10 dietary pattern recommendations. The debate proposition is as follows. Ultra-processed foods are bad for health. Austin, you get to take the lead.
Okay. I'm going to respond in the negative and say ultra-processed foods are not bad for health. And the reason I'm going to say that is that kind of in line with some of our previous questions relating to definitions, I think that the definition of an ultra-processed food is a very poor one. For a lot of people, they mentally go to the right place, for example, like thinking about high fat, sugar, salt foods. I've even seen this labeled as like HFSS foods or something like that. But they mentally conflate the two and say that they're the same. That a food is processed in some way does not automatically make it unhealthy. And so I think this is a pretty unhelpful categorization based on the formalized definitions. Whereas I think it's a pretty useful definition in just like the layperson's assumption of like what that means. If you're assuming it to mean effectively junk food, the HFSS category, if we want to make up a new one there, then sure, I'm on board with that. That reducing foods that are enriched in those particular substances that are, you know, packaged and designed to be hyper palatable and minimally satiating and things like that, I think it is generally wise for health to minimize or reduce people's consumption of those things. But just because a food is processed, I don't think that that's as useful of a criterion if we're going to apply, you know, actual rigid definitions of processing to a food item and then automatically label it as unhealthy. I think there's a fair amount of even packaged foods or foods that come in cans or jars or boxes or something like that, that you can get at a grocery store that would qualify as being processed or sometimes even ultra processed, that contain generally healthful ingredients. And I would not feel as confident that they have universally adverse health consequences. We've cited before, for example, that whey protein would technically be considered like a pretty processed food item, right? And so that's just an immediate, you know, exception that invalidates the rule, I say.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually don't disagree with your take, but I'm forced to take the affirmative. So the only way I can do that through the lens of scientific evidence is by backing up to a broader scale, because the idea that the classification of ultra processed foods sort of shape food related behavior, I think, underpins this entire idea, right? Like, oh, if we classify foods as ultra processed and, you know, that's, you know, advertised or marked on the label, like people are going to make different food related behaviors, food related decisions. And I do not think that is the case. So rather, if I back up to a broader scope that say that, hey, ultra processed foods in the food environment are, you know, pretty bad for health or lead to worse health outcomes, I think I can support that pretty strongly, just because most of the ultra processed foods on the market today are very tasty. They're very cheap, easily available, they're desirable, and they're not very satiating, and they are ubiquitous in the food environment. If there were less of them, people would be eating less calories per day on average and have a more health-promoting dietary pattern. It would also likely increase food insecurity on some levels. So this is not just like, hey, we just get rid of all the ultra-processed foods, everybody's hunky-dory. That is not what I'm necessarily advocating for. But I think I can make a strong argument that if we removed ultra-processed foods from the diet in this hypothetical, you know, utopian world and everybody got fed, we'd likely be better off. It is possible that in the future, ultra-processed foods become more satiating. They are engineered in a way to still be palatable, still be desirable, still be cheap, readily accessible, and so on, but are also very satiating. So people would eat less of them, but that's still a ways off and remains yet to be seen.
What do you think would be the incentive for that, though? I don't see why that would happen.
Don't know. They would have to be some sort of government subsidy to ultimately like make it very financially attractive for folks, or some sort of like massive social pressure to do so. Right. The biggest issue here, though, is that I don't think that public knowledge of whether or not something is processed or not really alters food-related behaviors. And in fact, you know, there's some moderate evidence on, you know, different food labeling, you know, strategies that have had some effect on food-related behaviors. So like listing calories at restaurants, for example, does seem to have some effect on, in some studies, on people's food-related behaviors. Different sort of, you know, oh, is this a green labeled food or a red labeled food that can have effects on people's purchasing behaviors and so on. So I, you know, could make the argument that, yeah, maybe if you label it as ultra processed and there's this general understanding that ultra processed foods are, quote, bad, maybe people would eat less of them. But I am skeptical that that would make a big enough effect to sort of really put a dent in people's the obesity epidemic, for example. But on the other hand, if you remove these hyper palatable ultra processed foods with added sodium, added sugar, added fats from the food environment, damn. You could, I mean, you know, snap your fingers and the obesity epidemic overnight would be, we would have a, make a big sort of impact there. So that's kind of, that's how I would have to come at this to actually argue against you in an evidence-based fashion.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I think that it's quite clear that on a population level, eating behaviors are super complex. And this is, I guess, one theoretical way by which you could attack it. And I don't know that we've had great success, but having you, unfortunately, if you want to do one, any of those kind of food labeling systems or stoplight system or something, you have to have some criteria. And I think that our shared position would be that just like calling it ultra processed or not is not the best criterion for like green light versus red light. There should be, and I don't think there are many people out there that are proposing that actually be the sole criterion for such things. But it's a super over reductive to the point of being incorrect in many cases criterion.
Yeah, it is funny. Like, so like ultra processed is kind of a meaningless term. There's no real consensus definition on what it is. We use the NOVA definition, which even at its origin, like people are like, oh, what does NOVA stand for? You're like, nothing. It's not even. You're like, wait, so it's, we're just making things like in the actual organization's name? Come on. Anyway, yeah, it's kind of funny. All right, last question here on Great Debates number 5 with Dr. Austin Baraki. All right, so had a little game time decision plot twist to our last question because I actually had a question that we already answered before. So this question is new. And the debate proposition is as follows: industry-funded studies invalidate their findings. Did you go first last time or did I go first?
Yeah, I went first.
Okay, so I'll go first. So I'll have to respond in the negative that industry-funded studies do not invalidate their findings. The idea that something that has been sponsored by industry or that has been, researchers have received donations from industries, I certainly think there's a high degree or high probability of bias in those studies. You would predict more bias than a non-industry funded study. Certainly, no disagreement there. However, the idea that scientists would manipulate studies, manipulate findings, publish research to a significant degree universally, I think is something that I can't really get behind. You know, this organized deception of the public. But yeah, there's some bias in there and there's bias in all research. I think when you're looking to come up with an answer for a question that can be answered through scientific data, you're looking for converging lines of evidence. And some of some of that evidence is likely to come from industry-funded studies, because otherwise, how do you get the money to actually study the stuff? Like phase 2, phase 3 clinical trials. Like, who do you think has to put up the money for that? You know, it's gonna be industry. And yeah, it's not necessarily perfect all of the time, but we can't use this unicorn fallacy to like negate the entire field. What you're looking for then are multiple studies all finding a similar thing with a similar size of effect, and it gives you a general impression of what the relationship is between the intervention, between the medication, between the treatment or lack thereof, and the sort of outcome. And I think that's how you kind of come to a sense of, or a consensus of, here's where the science currently sits. Would I prefer more studies to analyze that had less industry funding overall? Sure. That would make me feel maybe a little bit better, but I don't necessarily know that just you should, if you see that the funding source is industry, you should just not read it and ignore it. I think that'd be a pretty extreme take that ultimately would leave you relatively uninformed with respect to trying to use scientific evidence to come up with an answer.
Yeah, I think this is, I don't really see a way to just flatly agree with this and say, yeah, all industry funded studies have invalid findings. I think that it's just one of the many variables that you can note in your interpretation of a publication. There are, you mentioned a few others. One is converging lines of evidence. We don't always have that luxury of multiple different studies, of multiple different methodologies looking at something. Somebody's always got to start first. And sometimes the first study is something that comes published from industry. In which case, there are other things that I might look at. For example, what was my prior probability of this working or not working, right? In other words, before I knew anything about this study, what, based on the state of our understanding of things, was the likelihood that this was going to work or not, right? If I thought it was highly, 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 highly improbable to work, and then the study shows, oh, it's a huge effect, it really works. Okay, well, I have questions, right? Maybe this is earth-shattering, groundbreaking work, or maybe there's something fishy going on here. So I interpret the study's findings in the context of what my pretest probability was, effectively, like a Bayesian kind of thought process here. The next thing is, what's the actual study looking at? For example, like, yes, I will, maybe this is one of my own biases, but I will readily admit that I have a bit more skepticism around industry-funded studies as it relates to supplements than I do over, you know, pharmaceuticals, for example. I think that the supplement industry, by and large, is super untrustworthy and unreliable. I think that, not to say that I'm, you know, a huge fan of everything Big Pharma has ever done, if you want to use that term, but that's kind of where my natural skepticism tends to lie. So applying some pretest kind of suspicion in the context of the study's findings, what are we actually talking about? What are we looking at? And then the last, you know, you have to look at the actual methods that were used, and then do they show you the raw open data, or is it just like the method section is super vague? The actual data from the trial is not accessible to the public, not openly published, not available in a supplement. All of that stuff is hidden. If the interpretation and the analysis was done by the, you know, company that funded it, that might raise a little bit more suspicion compared to blinded interpretation by a separate organization or something like that. So there's just a whole lot of layers to looking at this kind of question. But I think that anybody who takes this position and says it's all invalidated findings, I don't really know what they expect, how they expect progress to be made. Running trials, particularly rigorous, well-designed, and large enough trials to find good effects when they exist, is expensive and time-consuming. And that just doesn't materialize out of nowhere. And so, you know, interestingly, like many of the people who would take this kind of position also tend to be people who are like very much pro-capitalism and things like that. And it's like, okay, well, that's the system that we're in, and that's where the incentives come from for these companies to do this work. We don't see all of these groundbreaking products that do have huge effects coming out of alternative systems by and large. So I did not overtly disagree with you or take the opposing position, because I don't really know that it's possible. But I think it hopefully illustrated there's a lot more layers to looking at these kind of things and interpreting them and deciding what's the likelihood that I'm going to incorporate this into my practice day to day.
Yeah. In fact, I'm less concerned about the funding source, I guess, than I am publication bias and things that lead into publication bias. So, for example, most people, but researchers have a tendency to publish things when there is a finding, a significant finding versus a non-significant finding, or that there's some sort of positive result rather than a negative result. There's all sorts of, different pushes and pulls of researchers to publish certain things and not publish other things. And that is due more to the research system as it is currently, and the education system, the academic system by and large. So there are a lot of different layers here. So I have more concerns about that. So if I look at 100 studies on a particular topic, I know that there are probably another 100 that remain unpublished, and that might significantly influence my consensus on what the data actually shows. And I'm more concerned with that than if half of the studies that I reviewed were funded by industry in that case.
Yeah, fully agree. You actually took something that I meant to say in my answer, because one of the other things that you can look at when trials are published was the trial pre-registered? And were the outcomes that were published in the trial when it actually came out the same outcomes that were listed in the trial pre-publication? In other words, because in a pre-registration, they say, here's what we're going to do, here's what we're going to look at, here's the outcomes that we're going to measure. And then if you go to the paper when it was published and it all matches, then good, that's actually pretty reassuring, regardless of the funding source. But suddenly, if you go to the publication at the end and they're like, oh, well, we changed our outcome to become like this composite outcome of like 8 different things that we found was, you know, barely statistically significant finding, so we called it a positive trial, that's a lot shadier. This publication bias is, I agree, a far more concerning thing to me than the funding purely on its own, independent of any other considerations.
Yeah, I don't want that to distract from the actual thing. Like, yeah, industry funding, that's a source of bias. And should definitely be within, you know, in your calculus when you're assessing and reading data and trying to, again, come up with a consensus of what does all the data show. But I don't think, you know, taking the hard stance that it invalidates the findings That is something I would not get on board with unless there were other things that led me to believe that the author and research group's integrity should be called into question, whether it's, you know, previous redactions, whether it's, you know, to your point, not pre-registered outcomes, you know, evidence of P hacking. They looked for 50 different things and found one slightly significant sort of finding. Those things I'd be more concerned with over the funding. But funding is definitely something you think about.
Yeah, I think taking this position very strongly would be an example of like smooth brain critical thinking.
Yeah,
it's like something that feels like critical thinking if you don't actually know how to do that.
Yeah, if you don't think about it, it makes sense. Nice. All right, that's a wrap here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Great debates, number 5. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Baracchi for sharing his time and wisdom with us. Always love having him on the podcast. But before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.